Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Rico Browning played the Gill Man in the underwater scenes for all three of the Creature from the Black Lagoon films.
We shot in the wintertime at Wakulla Springs, and water temperature was about 51. The air temperature at that time was 49, so it got pretty chilly.
We'll discuss the often overlooked accomplishments of Ponce de Leon.
If the inclusion or exclusion of Juan Ponce de Leon from college-level textbooks is any indication, he is generally allotted only a sentence or two, or ignored entirely.
And we'll talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe and Florida tourism. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Native Floridian Rico Browning is best known for portraying the Gill Man in all of the underwater scenes for the three Creature from the Black Lagoon films. Browning was also the creative force behind the film and TV series Flipper and worked on many other projects, including the James Bond movie Thunderball. Browning died in February 2023 at the age of 93. We spoke with him in 2018. Rico Browning got his start in the early 1950s, entertaining tourists at Weekiwachee.
We put on an underwater night show at Weekiwachee, and it was very successful. However, there was only one motel at Weekiwachee at that time, and you had to travel 18 miles into Brooksville to get to the next motel. So I got the bright idea, why not go to Silver Springs? Because they got motels everywhere, and tourists, and do an underwater show there at night. So I came up and talked to Bill Ray, who was the son of Ray Davidson and Ray, and his brother, Buck Ray, who was the general manager. And I talked to them about doing a night show at Silver Springs and building an underwater theater. And they turned me down. But just as I was leaving, Bill Ray said, Rico, look, why don't you let me give you a job here? And over a period of time, we'll talk them into doing it. I said, well, fine. So he made me the assistant director of public relations at Silver Springs. And I was in that job for about 5 years.
Rico Browning met director Jack Arnold and was hired to portray the Gill Man in all of the underwater scenes for Creature from the Black Lagoon. He wore a distinctive, cumbersome costume.
I put it this way, when you're a kid and you play football, you put on a uniform, shoulder pads and everything, and it's pretty clumsy. But when you get in a game, you forget you even have it on. So it was about the same with the suit. It was a little awkward, but once I got into the water and started using it, I forgot I have it on. It was sponge rubber covered with latex, and I had to wear lead weights, chest plate, thigh pads of lead, and lead around my ankles so I'd sink because it was made of rubber. And we shot in the wintertime at Wakulla Springs, and water temperature was about 51. The air temperature at that time was 49. So it got pretty chilly. Yeah, cold.
One of the most suspenseful scenes in the 1954 film Creature from the Black Lagoon has scientist Kay Lawrence, played by Julie Adams, taking a swim, unaware that the Gill Man creature is swimming just below her. The scene was challenging for Browning.
We had a director, nice man, but he couldn't swim. So he was in an inner tube on the surface looking down at what we were doing. So the cameraman, Scotty Welburn, kind of took over directing underwater. And so he said, well, let's swim downriver with Ginger and get the scene of following her. And so I swam with her, and vision was the poorest thing in the suit. the eye sat about an inch away from my eye, and I didn't use a face mask or a goggle because if they filled with water, I couldn't get rid of the water, so I went with a naked eye. So it was a blurred vision looking through a keyhole. So the only way I could see her was when I swam upside down. So I had to swim upside down underneath her in order to follow her down the river.
Most of the underwater filming for Creature from the Black Lagoon was done at Wakala Springs, but some was done at Silver Springs.
At Silver Springs, downriver, about a quarter of a mile, there's a little spring on the left with a house. And we used that spring there to shoot the scenes of the creature trying to move all the logs and everything. And that was shot here at Silver Springs. The rest of it was shot at Wakala Springs.
Browning would reprise his underwater role for the two Creature from the Black Lagoon sequels, the only actor to portray the Gill Man in all three films. After the Creature series of films, Browning became the stuntman and underwater director for the TV show Sea Hunt, working with producer Ivan Tors.
He's quite a guy, very sharp, and we did a third year of Sea Hunt at Silver Springs and shot all the episodes for that year. And I was hired to just be the bad guy. And I would fight Courtney Brown, who was the double for Lloyd Bridges, in just about every scene. And I had to wear different bathing suits, different hair makeup, either go as a blonde or a brunette, or wear a hood. I enjoyed it very much. And we then moved to Nassau and shot the remaining couple of years of Sea Hunt over there.
After the success of Sea Hunt, Browning and co-writer Jack Cowden took the story of a very intelligent dolphin named Flipper to producer Ivan Tors.
We wrote it as a book, and we went to Lake Weir, Bruce Mozart's house, and we spent the whole week and weekend writing this little book. And so we wrote it, and I went to New York with my last $200 and tried to promote it as a book. And I went to three publishing houses, and one seemed very interested, and I never heard back from them. I left them with a book and some pictures and drawings and everything. And so I got the bright idea that if I could say a producer in Hollywood is considering it as a movie, maybe they'll publish the book. So I called Ivan and I said, "Ivan, will you do me a favor?" I said, "I'd like to get my book published about a boy and a dolphin. And would you say you're considering it as a movie?" He said, "Yeah, well, okay." And he said, "But send me a copy." So I did. I mailed him a copy. And I called the book company and I said, "Hey, the producer in Hollywood wants to make this into a movie. Can we get the book going?" And they talked and hemmed and hawed, and I never heard back from them. But I did hear from Ivan. Ivan said, "I didn't read your book." He said, "But my wife did, and she loved it. So she made me read it. I love it." He said, "Let's make a movie." So he got the money from MGM. And we made the first feature and then 4 years of television.
They call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he. And we know Flipper lives in a world full of wonder, flying there under the sea.
Rico Browning discovered a special dolphin named Mitzi to play Flipper on screen.
So I spent the next 3-4 months training Mitzi to do the things that we needed for the show. Well, I wasn't an animal trainer, and I had to learn with the dolphin. And one of the hardest things was to get the dolphin to ride the boy, and I couldn't figure out exactly how to do it. But I would throw a ball or whatever, and she would retrieve it and bring it back. And my son was there with me, helping train her, and he was a little boy, and he had on cut-off jeans. And I got the bright idea, if she retrieves a ball, why not retrieve a boy? So I said, "Ricky, do me a favor." I said, "When I throw the ball, you jump in the water, and we'll see what Mitzi does." So I did, and he jumped in the water, and she tried to bring him to me. And she didn't know how to do it. So she'd grab the little loops in his cut-off jeans and try to pull him. Well, he accidentally put his hand up in the water and got caught onto her fin, and she rode him right to me. I said, hey, this is great. So I said, go way across the pond, and I'm going to throw the ball over your head. You jump in the water over there. And when she comes, hold on to her and see if she brings you to me. And it was quite a distance. And I threw the ball way over his head. He jumped in the water. She went over there and rode him right to me.
Actor, filmmaker, and native Floridian Rico Browning played the Gill Man in the underwater scenes for all three Creature from the Black Lagoon films. Browning died in 2023. We spoke with him in 2018. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public TV series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in 2013, as Florida commemorated the 500th anniversary of the landing of Juan Ponce de Leon on the peninsula, many historians and celebratory event planners struggled with the question of how to present the explorer, who is often caricatured as the searcher for the mythical Fountain of Youth.
If the inclusion or exclusion of Juan Ponce de Leon from college-level textbooks is any indication, he is generally allotted only a sentence or two, or ignored entirely. In a 2015 article titled Throwing the Explorer Out with the Fountain, Roger Chapman surveyed college American history textbooks spanning a date range from the 1870s to 2013, and notes that despite Ponce's impressive list of accomplishments, quote, when compared with the other explorers of his day, he is admittedly less well known, end quote. Citing Elisha Benjamin Andrews' 1904 History of the United States, Chapman declares the scholar's treatment of Ponce a narration with, quote, some detail and fairly accurate, end quote. In comparison, the 2013 edition of the popular America, A Narrative History by George B. Tyndall and David E. Shee, quote, render the Florida expedition in a single sentence. Juan Ponce de Leon, then governor of Puerto Rico, made the earliest known exploration of Florida in 1513, end quote. Chapman then lays out his analysis for why Ponce de Leon deserves a more thorough treatment of his role in the so-called Age of Exploration. Chapman argues that although Juan Ponce was not as well known as some of his contemporaries, textbooks, quote, could better inform readers of this man's importance in American history, end quote. Ponce was, quote, a crew member of Christopher Columbus's second voyage to the Western Hemisphere and was on hand for the European discovery of San Juan Bautista, Puerto Rico, which is now an unincorporated territory of the United States. He later colonized San Juan Bautista and, as the provincial governor, helped establish the city of San Juan, which today boasts the oldest European-made structures on U.S. territory. On April 3, 1513, he became the first European to officially set foot on land that is now part of the state of Florida, whatever spot that may have been. During the 1513 Florida voyage, he was the first recognized European to discover the Gulf Stream, end quote. Chapman also notes that, quote, in certain aspects, American history begins in Florida. Citing Robert H. Fuson's 2000 book, Juan Ponce de Leon and the Spanish Discovery of Florida, he makes larger claims for the Florida voyage. Quote, by the time that St. Augustine was settled, the entire Atlantic coast of America, from today's Florida to southern Canada, was known as La Florida.
Connie, in his 2003 Short History of Florida, Michael Gannon claims, quote, not until the year 2055 will an American flag have flown over Florida, as long as did the flag of Spain, end quote. And yet the Spanish influence on Florida, like the story of Ponce, appears very briefly, if at all, in the national narrative.
Chapman traces the omission to some of the earliest textbooks published in the late 19th century and offers an explanation rooted in inherited historical perspectives. An 1896 textbook includes chapters on Indians, Norsemen, Columbus, Americus Vespucius and Balboa, Sir Francis Drake and Captain John Smith and Virginia, but no Ponce and no Florida. As he notes later, quote, even when the Spanish get credit, as in Harry J. Carman's 1967, A History of the American People, a negative slant prevails. Quoting Carman, quote, in Florida, St. Augustine was the only important town founded by the Spanish. It had a population of about 5,000 when the English took control of it in 1763, end quote. Chapman attributes the omission of Spanish influence on colonial North America to what he labels as Hispanophobia, quote, a legacy of the rivalry between Spain and England during the colonial period, a rivalry over land and religion, end quote, pitting Protestant England against Catholic Spain. English writers and historians pointed to the Inquisition and the brutal reputation of Spanish conquistadors while depicting English actions in the language of settlement. As one mid-19th century textbook explains, quote, the Spaniards were cruel and avaricious. They did not come to America to till the soil and follow honest labor, but with extravagant hopes of becoming suddenly rich from mines of gold and silver. But the English were industrious people who loved liberty and humanity and earned success by energetic toil in the fields, end quote. Casting Spain in the role of other, cruel, brutal, anti-liberal, and an enemy of freedom complicated any history of Florida and Juan Ponce de Leon.
And clearly a case can be made that Ponce deserves more attention in the national narrative than he has received, but that still begs the question, how should historians deal with the story that every child knows about the search for the Fountain of Youth?
Tracing the source of the tales that Ponce sought the Fountain of Youth proves as problematic as other aspects of the Florida voyage. As early as 1871, some scholars cast doubt on the story. In a 1948 book on Florida, Catherine Hanna noted that the fountain story was ubiquitous in Ponce's time and asserted that there was, quote, no real evidence that the stories influenced Ponce's decisions, end quote. Journalist T.D. Allman claimed that Washington Irving concocted the story in his 1828 book, Voyages and Discoveries of the Companions of Columbus. But Irving spent 7 years conducting research at the National Archives in Madrid and consulting with Spanish historians before writing his book. Knowing Irving's extensive research would seem to negate claims that he concocted the story. Rather than an endless debate over whether Ponce searched for a fountain of youth in a specific place, Chapman offers a more compelling analysis of the narrative. In his 1992 book, The Buried Mirror, Reflections on Spain and the New World, Carlos Fuentes observed, quote, the conquistadors were driven not only by the lust of gold, but by fantasy, illusion, imagination, end quote. This important observation, according to Chapman, shows how the fountain story is indicative of the culture in which Ponce and his companions existed and explains not only the fountain myth, but also the search for Cibola, El Dorado, and the Houses of Sun. As Chapman explains, stories about the myths and legends that inspired the Spanish explorers may seem absurd and idiosyncratic to a modern readership, but they nonetheless humanized the Spaniards by highlighting their curiosity and sense of wonder. As Chapman concludes, quote, the limited record on Juan Ponce was not always handled judiciously as the top scholars focused their attention on other conquistadors. Textbook writers looked over the shoulders of other writers, passing along the same mistakes, end quote. While the Fountain of Youth may be, quote, Florida's most enduring myth, as J. Michael Francis asserts, By giving Juan Ponce de Leon's short shrift, American history books miss an opportunity to show that at one level, America's oldest European roots are actually Spanish, end quote.
And it is ironic that one of the most popular stories from Florida history is actually a myth. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. A new statue of Harriet Beecher Stowe will be unveiled on Sunday, November 17th at the Mandarin Museum and Historical Society. Sebastian Garcia has this look at Stowe's impact on Florida tourism.
John T. Foster, Jr. is a professor emeritus of anthropology at Florida A&M University. He co-authors Beechers, Stowe's, and Yankee Strangers, The Transformation of Florida, and the award-winning Calling Yankees to Florida, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Forgotten Tourist Articles, originally released in 1999 and 2011, respectively. I spoke with John about those two works and his broader research regarding Harriet Beecher Stowe and her time in Florida. Most famously known for her 1852 anti-slavery novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Stowe also played a pivotal role in one of the first attempts to quote-unquote modernize Florida immediately after the Civil War. In 1864, after successfully launching a reform initiative that maintained Kansas as a free state before the Civil War, Stowe and her northerner partners searched for other areas that could benefit from their reform efforts, particularly in the South. Florida's demographics circa 1864, a scarce population and an almost equal ratio between white and black people, provided the impetus for Stowe to choose Florida as her next freedom project.
This group of people then determined and decided that they wanted to, in fact, create a place of freedom in the South. And so they looked around and they're looking at the demographics, and Florida did not have 190,000 residents in 1870, let alone 1865. But in 64, the organization put out a proclamation in the Atlantic Monthly that Florida was going to, in fact, be a place of freedom. And they were going to encourage people to move there, to move the balance of things in the direction of genuine freedom. Keep in mind that the black population was almost equal to the white population. So if you had real voting, then it opened the possibilities for there to being real freedom.
Stowe leveraged her status as the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, the best-selling novel of the 19th century and the second best-selling book in that century after the Bible, to encourage Northerners to invest their resources in Florida. In other words, she used the medium that elevated her as a recognizable figure to promote Florida as a place of freedom.
These are people who are using media. They are writing things. So you may say, well, what did Harriet Beecher Stowe do? She wrote 57 articles about coming to Florida, or life in Florida, or traveling in Florida. She wrote 18 of those from 1867 to about 1871. In 72, she wrote 17 more, and she made them into a book called Palmetto Leaves, and it was very popular. And then after this, she wrote another 22. My wife and I did a continuation on her efforts. You see, she used 17 articles out of 57. So that's 40 of them that she didn't use. Well, we went through and picked out the best of those. She did not make many trips in 72. But guess what she did 73 or 4? She goes to Silver Springs herself. And her account is in our book called Calling Yankees to Florida. You can read it for yourself. It's one of the most dramatic accounts. Can you imagine seeing Silver Springs before it was all messed up? Hey, how about by torchlight? They visited it like 1 o'clock in the morning.
When I asked John to share some examples from Stowe's Forgotten Florida Tourist Articles, he shared with me the following.
Stover Self buys an orange grove in Mandarin. And so she's continually, or frequently, that is, talking about what is doable with them. So they're trying to move people away from cotton, away from that kind of production, to all kinds of different things. She was also encouraging education. She got a school built in Mandarin in 1870. It burned to the ground under mysterious circumstances. She said accident. It may not have been. Guess what? They rebuilt it. The building still stands in Mandarin. So she is encouraging education, and she's doing this for everyone, not just whites. She is assuming that if she does and describes the place as it really is, the beauty of the orange groves. And by the way, she's describing orange groves in the Jacksonville area. Well, they were destroyed by freezes at the end of the 19th century. So she's describing the beauty of these places. So she's letting Florida speak for itself. So one of the things that we have found, my wife and I did, is that Florida tourism dramatically increased, but in a period where the historians are not aware of it.
Indeed, John contends that Stowe's obscurity in Florida's historical record stems from early 20th century commentators who wrote histories of Florida tourism that refused to acknowledge the centrality of Northerners like Stowe in that development.
There is a history of Jacksonville, and the history covers all of this period. And the author of it was T. Frederick Davis. He's the son of a Confederate officer. So guess what he does? He doesn't talk about Stowe at all. So this is written and published in 1925. He talks about tourism is taking off, but never explains who started it and why. So here's a man who's living in an economy created by these, if you wish, woke writers, and he's ignoring them. What he does say is that there were people who came into Jacksonville in this period who were motivated, and he said that they were fanatics rather than a patriot. And so you have histories that ignore this period. So if you have a problem with it, pretend it doesn't exist. The state of Florida published a history of tourism in 1930 called Florida Empire of the Sun. And they take the position that tourism began in 1880. And they not only state that lie, they repeat it 10 pages later. And so here's an effort of people in the Jim Crow period just deciding they're going to ignore parts of history because it isn't the kind of song and dance they want.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.